Hello, friends, and thanks for listening. I wanted to drop in with a quick note before the show gets rolling. I meant to get this episode out earlier last week, around Friday, and then Monday, and things just did not go according to plan. I had a lot of very stressful things come up at work in my day job, and that just took away from the time I had to do the show. In fact, while John and I were recording on Wednesday last week, I got something in for work that I had to actually stop everything and handle. It's very stressful. And so we didn't quite get to everything that we wanted to talk about this episode. We were going to talk about the UAW vote in Chattanooga, Tennessee, of the Volkswagen plant. We unfortunately didn't get to it. But honestly, it works out better because when we were recording, it was before the vote actually took place. And since then, the union and Chattanooga had an overwhelming victory, and we're excited to talk more about that this upcoming week. But I just wanted to let you all know that that's why this episode is late. That's why we're missing some of the content that we had planned on talking about. Again, I apologize for that, but sometimes, unfortunately, life just gets in the way. But this episode is still good, believe me. We start out by talking about some of our favorite comments left on John's Ponderosa throwback video on TikTok as a fun, lighthearted opener. I hope you all enjoy that. We've got a great interview with a gentleman who made a podcast documentary about the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. Fascinating. I'm really excited for y'all to hear it. And then Big John, as always, has a beef. So thank you all again for being such dedicated listeners. We appreciate you so much. And we'll be back next week with a fuller show. And yeah, thank you all, and enjoy this one. Perhaps. Look, all I'm going to say is, we can start. All I'm going to say is, we're going to be talking about some comments we got on TikTok from an old clip from the show, which I'll play the audio from so that y'all can hear it.
It was this magical place where when you walked in, instead of just ordering the buffet, you ordered an entree, and then, like the greatest restaurant in the world, you are so taken care of at Ponderosa that when you order this entree, You're not getting a salad for your side. You're not getting French fries for your side. You're getting an entire buffet as your side to your entree.
Where John was, I think, having a fantasy in episode about Ponderosa, the buffet. And to get started this episode today, this week, we're going to revisit some of those comments on TikTok, because I think we might have found a community that is as supportive of buffets as us.
I love it. I'm so happy.
Look, TikTok is, usually I don't go to TikTok comment sections to find inspiration. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. That's fair.
Okay, the first one, and I'm going to just read the usernames too, because none of them seem like they're very revealing of who they are, and plus they're public comments.
Sure.
Who gives a shit? This one from Southern Cross 47. My mom's water broke at a Ponderosa in 1990.
Bro. Okay. Imagine, Chuck, in 1990, if I told you your life will literally never get better upon birth.
That would suck, because I was born in 1990.
I know, but your mom didn't have you in a Ponderosa. So, like, your life can only...
Well, that's true.
Your life can only go up, right?
Okay, yeah.
You're telling me that this person was literally born into royalty? There's only a handful of people ever born in Ponderosa buffets.
Okay, well, there is a technicality here, which is that they didn't birth the child. Oh, I inquired further.
Okay.
I said, did she finish her meal first? Because she didn't say that she delivered the child. She just said her water broke. And I said, did she finish her meal? And she said, oh, hell yeah, absolutely. Boomer parents would never miss a meal for a child.
Dude, and I'm telling you, the perfect person to go to a Ponderosa buffet, if you can't go with me, okay, in my brick house large pants, are people wearing mm-hmm. maternity clothes. Because they got some big-ass pockets, dude.
Vic Victory, great name, said, I remember going, but I'm too young to know what I'm missing. And that's sad as a buffet connoisseur myself.
What was that person's name?
Vic Victory.
Vic Victory sounds like a good person. Probably a person.
He does, but...
Yeah, that does a lot of good for the community, even.
I would just throw out there, and this is controversial, I'm going to say it. Can you call yourself a buffet connoisseur if you have not been to Ponderosa, though, and remember it?
I didn't want my new friend Vic and I to get into it, so I didn't want to be the one to say it. So I appreciate being the dick about that. You're 100% right. I mean, if you haven't been to the Big Three, if you can't remember the Big Three, I mean, what are you – can you be a connoisseur?
What are you even doing – listening to the show?
Right. Like, you're going to tell me – what are you going to tell me next? You never been to a Bonanza? Okay, connoisseur.
Probably, yeah. I mean, look, and again, we appreciate Vic Victory's enthusiasm. We encourage him to broaden his horizons. I will say there were some negative comments. Right. A tactical Trash Panda 25
great
said,
minor league baseball team, the Trash Pandas.
Great minor league baseball team, absolutely. The Rocket City Trash Pandas. A lot of hot pot and Korean barbecue places are like this. You order whatever you want, and they have access to, like, a whole buffet. Okay, what's even the point?
Well,
it's not Ponderosa. That's all I need.
Also, not right. Incorrect.
Okay, fact check.
I've been to. My wife hates how I say hot pot because the P that comes. I don't know why. Like, I say it just to piss her off. I say hot.
How does she say?
Well, she says, you know, she says it, but the way that I pop when I say P, like a P word, she hates it. Anyway,
Say it again. Say it again.
Hot pot. Okay. She hates the
Okay, well, that's she would hate editing podcasts because that's all that's, that P's
dude,
are.
She okay, come on. We've had a lot of podcasts. She's listened to zero. So
that's true. We're still trying.
Yeah, but she has been on a Patreon exclusive. So there is that. But anyway, I've been to plenty. There is not a single time where I have gone in, ordered an entree. While waiting for my entree, I thought, you know what I should do? Get other foods that would also be considered an entree, create a bunch of different plates, eat as much as I want, and then take my entree home because I ate too much.
Yeah.
Also,
absolutely.
I've never been able to steal cookies in my pockets at a hot pot. I mean, I love those places.
No.
But I've never had cookies in my pants.
Important distinction to be made. One place, cookies and pants. The other place, no cookies and pants. I think
okay.
That's an important distinction.
Which one you picking? Cookies and pants.
Look, I love a good Korean barbecue, but
I do too.
I mean, the
and
choice
there's,
is obvious.
There's nothing. Look, there is nothing better than that. But
nothing.
It ain't Ponderosa, and that's okay. It's different.
It's okay. Yeah, you don't have to be better. You can just be different.
Yeah.
AJ said, my best friend ate bad chowder there and barfed all over the table. He drove us all home with his puke hand out the window.
Two things I need to say to that. One, one, good for AJ to be able to drive home. Two, probably shouldn't eat a Ponderosa buffet if you got a weak stomach. That's just what I'm saying.
Truthfully, yeah, I agree, and maybe he should have gotten a DD there because, you know, if you can't handle the food, you can't handle the drive there.
I never drove to Ponderosa when I ate there.
That's a great point. I didn't either.
Nope.
That's a great point.
To be fair, I was 8, so, but
same.
But I always had a BD. Always had a BD. Buffet driver.
A buffet. God. This one's going to take a turn. Theo said, my grandmother got banned from a Ponderosa for getting angry and flipping a table.
Wow.
Sounds lit as fuck, but in parentheses, she was homophobic and horrible. Oh. I miss Ponderosa more than I miss her.
Okay. Theo. Two things. One, I also miss Ponderosa more than I miss my grandma. That's fair.
That might be the most Appalachian story ever. Homophobic grandma flips a table at Ponderosa. This one was from Bing Bong. The only time I ever went to a Ponderosa was the one still open in Taichung, Taiwan, and it was awesome. I need a fact check on that. Is there a Ponderosa in Taiwan?
Please, let's find this out.
Okay, I'm Googling it. I don't... that is... Oh, my God. I'm genuinely shocked in the moment. This is... I did not look this up, but I'm very impressed.
Yep. I'd know that steak from anywhere, Chuck.
I genuinely am shocked. Oh, man. This person sounds like... Heidi, stop doing that.
Heidi.
She's got the cone on. She's licking the cone.
Dude, she's hungry.
She already ate. That's why it's all over the damn cone.
She knows how good the chicken wings are, dude. She knows.
Yeah. This guy sounds like he's from our high school. His name is Chemical Nick. He said, they would take my entire high school football team, 65 to 70 guys, to Ponderosa the night before game to carbo load. It was a crime zone.
That, honestly, if I was a head football coach, I wouldn't take them to carbo load the day before. They would have to win to get any Ponderosa. I don't take losers to Ponderosa.
It's a reward, not a prep.
Never have, never will. Everyone can have a trophy. Not everyone can have Ponderosa.
You don't get a participation buffet.
No, no, I've never gotten it.
I certainly haven't. I'm not spoiled. No. This one, so I've got two more. This one you're going to identify with. Actually, I'll leave that one for last. The next one is from I Am Meat. It said, for context, John was wearing a Mountaineer shirt. Mountaineer shirt tells me all I need to know. FYI, Morgantown lost its Ponderosa not long ago, but we are getting a Steak and Shake soon, .. I don't know what they're implying.
Okay, it could be one of two things, right? They see the West Virginia shirt, they know we're good people.
Sure.
Right?
Yep, could be.
Or two... They're like, oh, look, it's another West Virginia person talking about, you know, some type of buffet or blah, blah, blah.
White trash cuisine.
Yeah, some type of dumb stereotype. But I'm going to assume it was the first one because they did talk about Morgantown, which means they at least know Morgantown. So I'm going to assume that they meant that as a good thing. I don't know what the hell Steak and Shake has to do with Ponderosa.
It's not even remotely comparable.
I ain't never been able to get as many burgers as I wanted for one low price. Which is not comparable to Ponderosa.
Yeah, I don't recall Steak and Shake having unlimited soft serve ice cream, so.
Zero times. So I don't care if you're getting a Steak and Shake.
True.
Parkersburg lost theirs, and guess what? Never missed it.
Yeah, nothing ever survives in that traffic circle area. The last one, this one was genuinely hilarious. John Clemens 8373 said, I worked there as a 15-year-old. When I read that employees had options to buy stock at a discount, I went to the quote stock room and asked, how much for this number 10 can of pudding?
Dude, employee discounts are the best, so I can't blame them.
I didn't realize that they would just do that. You could just buy like buffet items at a discount. That's incredible.
I wish I would have worked there. I wish that was what I did with my life. Maybe I'll own a... You know what? I'm going to tell you now, if this podcast ever takes off and we become just super wealthy, I'm blowing money and opening a Ponderosa.
I think that would... I think our audience would be upset if we didn't do that, if you didn't do that. If some of that money didn't go to that, I assume that most of our Patreon members, patreon.com/appodlatcha, are funding this show because of hopes that they could be... angel investors in that operation, in that franchise.
I've often thought of Patreon as just angel investors into my Ponderosa franchise.
Let's go talk to our investors.
If you would like to become an angel investor in our Ponderosa Ponzi scheme, I just love Ponderosa. I just want to add it to everything. It is a Ponzi scheme. And patreon.com/appodlatcha and help me open a Ponderosa buffet close to my house.
Yeah, absolutely. You can join for $5 a month and get access to this video of this show. That's a cheap deal to look at these beautiful faces. So
look at this.
Well, let's wrap it up with Ponderosa, shall we? We spent the first 15 minutes of the show yapping about it, so let's move on. And we're going to move on to our interview. Our interview today is with JD Belcher. He is a podcaster, multimedia professional, business owner. He made a incredibly well-produced podcast documentary podcast. I don't know. I guess if that's a term, documentary. Who knows? A fantastic podcast that documents the Upper Big Branch mine disaster. It is phenomenal. I know that you all will really enjoy listening to it, and I hope that you enjoy listening to this interview as well that I did with him a few weeks ago. He's a really fascinating guy and really put his heart and soul into this project, and you can tell. It's one that's, you know, obviously very close to a lot of people's hearts, especially in West Virginia, and it's a difficult one to talk about. But he did a phenomenal job producing this. We get into a little bit of the process about it, why he wanted to do it, who he talked to, and it was just a really, really awesome conversation, and I hope that you all enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really excited when you reached out, because I mean, this topic has been one that's interested me and just with all the different facets of it for a really long time. And the fact that you were doing like a very well thought out produced podcast on it, it is awesome. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been overall a devastating experience, but it's took a little over 3 years now, and I'm just glad that I'm glad it's completed, and I hope that, you know, maybe it'll do some good somehow.
Absolutely. I want to definitely talk about that, but first I would love to understand a little bit more about your background, because you're producing this through your company, right?
I'm producing, so I have a marketing agency, but it's not affiliated with this project. I started an LLC. That's okay. I started Common Core Films LLC to do passion projects like this. So that's what this is through. But my company, you know, I could talk all about that if you want. But yeah, quick background. I was a former coal miner. I was a surface coal miner, and I started in 2005. Mm-hmm. And, you know, along the way, I worked my way up and eventually got a union job. And I worked for Massey a long time ago, which had an okay experience. And then I ended up working for Bluestone Coal. So I worked for both of the biggest coal producers at the time. And eventually I just wanted to do something else. So I learned to make videos.
Nice.
And, yeah. So yeah, and how deep you want me to go, I can go super. Okay.
Oh no, that's super totally deep. Fine. I wanted to know a little bit more about kind of how you got into this, but that's sure. Great. And where are you based out of right now? Where are you from originally?
Sure. So I grew up, I was born in Ashland, Kentucky. And then after my parents got divorced, we moved to Welch, West Virginia in fifth grade. So I grew up there my whole life, and went to Mount View High School and had a lot of good times there. So now, you know, we've lived in Pineville, and now we live actually in Beckley. So that's why this was really important for me too, because I'm going to be in this community. And I wanted to be sure to do something right by the community, because usually when, you know, stories are told by outsiders, and they're often, you know, not appealing to West Virginians at all. So that's kind of why I got into this, too, is to change the narrative of where I live.
Absolutely. I love that premise so much, and I think it's so necessary. One thing that I guess I try to explain sometimes, and even I'm not really the best at explaining it, because even though I grew up in West Virginia, I didn't grow up in a coal mining family, but coal is not just a job in West Virginia. It's part of the culture. And so I think when people approach stories like this that aren't familiar with West Virginia or from there, that's not fully understood that well. And I think because of that, they can't really tell the story properly. So I love that not only are you from West Virginia, but you have a coal mining background. Like you've been in the thick of it.
Sure. Yeah. And that too, like, you know, the typical stereotypes of West Virginians being, you know, unintelligent and hillbillies, and which, you know, we are, and things like that, you know, poverty stricken and all the usual stuff that they like to point their finger on is stuff that I just think is really lazy.
Yeah,
when it comes to storytelling. So, you know, my goal, you know, with everything I do, really, we have now we've done work for over 90 organizations, and I have a team of There's a team of seven of us.
Wow.
With JJ and Multimedia that are, you know, and we started from nothing. You know, we started from an idea, and we done that in, you know, what's considered the poorest region in the United States, one of the poorest. So, you know, I know for a fact, you know, with my, I had a 2.7 GPA in high school. I know for a fact that people can do nearly whatever they want, you know, if they put their mind to it. So, so yeah, it was just important that something like that. I mean, there's been several attempts to talk about UBB that are really, really good and heartfelt and meaningful. So this isn't to slight those, but this, you know, I've never really heard a project that was as emotional and caring as it was detailed as to the facts. So that's kind of, you know, the goal behind this. First, memorializing the 29 men and their families was in the forefront. Absolutely. You know, they are the victims here. They did nothing wrong. And I held that center, and then everything else, regardless of, you know, who the party was that had a role in this, just, you know, fell as it may. I didn't, you know, my main goal was to protect them and their families, and the rest, you know, just where the facts led me.
Absolutely. I respect that and agree with a whole lot. I want to ask you, you said that, you know, you started this LLC to do passion projects. I'm assuming this is obviously one of them. How did you first come up with the idea to do this? Was it just because you wanted to see this story told right? How did you get to that point?
Sure, that was definitely a part of it. But, you know, I kind of wanted, coal mining was really important to me. I mean, I dropped out of college twice in a row, and if it wasn't for coal mining and the ability to find a job to pay my bills and to feed my family, I don't know what I would have did. So, you know, I was just a bad coal miner. That's why I ended up leaving, is because I wasn't really good at it, you know, and I always had a creative brain and was always somewhere else. And I knew that, like, eventually if I kept on being that complacent, that I may hurt myself. So, but I love and appreciate it. Bought my first camera, you know, I couldn't have done this without it. So that's kind of, you know, we've done over 700 productions, like, commercially. I've been involved in over 700 rendered videos of some form. And I made a documentary called Corner to Fighter Story back in 2018. And that was about a boxing club in Welch, West Virginia. And it was so emotional and such a fun time to do and to learn about these fighters in essentially, you know, what's considered the poorest part of America. And it was really compelling and impactful for me. And it's on Amazon Prime if anyone wants to see it. I mean, I make like $4 a year on it. Like, it's not for money.
That's a fascinating premise, though. I mean, who's ever watched or heard a story about boxing in West Virginia? I can't think of many.
Yeah. So, and also on that, so big mentors of mine are Lane and Curran Sheldon.
And yeah. Okay.
They're, yeah, great people. So, like, they've pretty much walked me through the entire thing, and that it walked me through, meaning like, I'll send them questions and, you know, borderline be annoying about certain things every, you know, in every phase of my filmmaking life, because I just respect them so much. Elaine did Hollow, which included my family.
Oh, wow.
In it. Yeah. Linda McKinney is my mother-in-law, and she runs Five Loaves, Two Fishes Food Bank in Welch. And her doing that created a wave of positivity. And that was the early days when I just started thinking that I could maybe learn how to do this. And, you know, throughout that, I mean, just her doing that one thing caused a wave, like, ended up Parts Unknown came, and here's Anthony Bourdain sitting at our dinner table and talking to us and wondering what we think about things. And, you know, Mike Rowe ended up coming and putting a roof on the food bank. If Elaine didn't do that one thing, this other stuff never would have happened.
Wow.
So, that's what I bring into all projects. Like, you never know. The main goal is to be positive and be honest, and, you know, not with rose colored glasses, but approach the truth with humanity, if that makes sense. And then everything else will work out. And I've saw that happen with them. So to tie that into UBB, and that's a long way of saying this, but I basically wanted to connect my past life with my current life. So I thought, you know, who knows coal miners better than I do? I at least know their personality. I don't know much about underground, but I know coal miners and I know the type of people they are. And it's some of the best people on earth, hardest working, loving, caring fighters of their families on earth. And I wanted to do my part to approach this and in as much of a non-biased way as I possibly could, to just see where the facts led and to be honest with myself of like, I don't know exactly what I'm going to find, and whatever I find, I'm going to be honest about and report. So that's kind of how it started. And that was in, I think it was November of 2020 that I started thinking of the idea. And I started out like, oh, this is going to be a full-fledged video documentary film. And then I was like, this is going to be a three-part series. This is so long. And then I realized, like, to do the visual side of things, this is all self-funded by me. I'm not even taking a dollar for reimbursement. It's all nonprofit. So to have done the video side, I probably would have went bankrupt.
Jeez.
You know, because you have so much talent that needs to be involved on the video side of things to put it together. Not that you don't for audio, but it's a lot easier.
Yeah, for sure.
Tell the story for that. So it just kind of grew from there. And then eventually I figured out like, well, I can't really find anyone to fund this video version. So I kind of gave up. I gave up for several months. But then I picked it back up and I said, no, I think I can make this podcast. So I was able to do that. And I got just enough interviews to be able to tell the majority of the first person accounts that I felt were important, you know, from all aspects of this. I did have a couple failures along the way. I wasn't able to get a hold of anyone on any legal team to even return a phone call to talk about the trials. Yeah, I couldn't get anyone on the phone. Now, granted, maybe they didn't know. I'm not saying that. But I also couldn't get any mine rescue team members that first went in after it initially happened. I couldn't get any performance coal mine rescue team members, but you know, everything else, you know, I'm really happy with. I'm over 90% happy with this, and that's pretty good for me because I'm usually not happy with my work. I'm happy with the experience, but not the work usually.
Yeah. Well, especially for a project as important as this, I'm sure that there's a heightened level of scrutiny, self-scrutiny when it comes to putting something like this together. So that's really impressive and really great to hear. I have a question because in the description for the podcast, you said that you were hoping to provide answers to countless questions about this. What are some of the questions that you were hoping to provide answers for, and not to give much away, but were you able to find those answers?
Sure. Yes. So basically, I was able to find enough to give me a very balanced opinion as to what happened. There are things, you know, I basically started with, okay, well, I want to explain, first off, who these 29 men were as people, because we hear numbers so much. Like, I'll do a test. I'll ask you. This is usually my test. So what does the number 38 mean to you?
Maybe that's like midway through life expectancy.
Gotcha. That's a good answer. So, yep. So what does the number 29 mean to you?
Well, now it means this, but before that, it would have meant the last vestige of my 20s left before I broke into my dreaded 30s.
Right. I gotcha. So basically what that is 29 does represent the miners who were lost. What a lot of people don't realize is 38 represents the biggest mine explosion before this of the number of miners that were lost in 1970. This happened in eastern Kentucky. So that, and you know, this did upset some people to hear, and understandably so. This should upset people. They should critique things. They should be, you know, this is a divisive subject. Now, granted, I don't want to hurt anyone, but I think it's important to remember this forever, because the mining industry gets complacent often. And when we get complacent, this stuff happens. You know, and that's complacency, you know, across the board with safety, with coal culture of, you know, putting profit over safety. That's unfortunately a thing. And I lived it, so I know. But, you know, the one thing that is also true is it is never, in my opinion, never any coal miner's fault. It is the fault of the mine operator to not run things properly. Now, granted, that could mean, you know, ensuring that the work that is being done is being done properly and, and doing safety checks and figuring out things. But I'm this, it's not the workers, because they're not cashing those big bonuses and they don't have those huge incentives to do things unsafe. So it's just never going to work with me. But anyway, and I'm rambling, but some of the questions, you know, basically I was able to explain who a few of these men were personally. I couldn't do all 29 because that would take a lot of resources. I hope to do that one day. But I found a diverse range of individuals who lost people in this. One lost his father, Mon Lynch, lost William Roosevelt Lynch in the explosion. And we hear about who his father was and how he was always taking care of his friends, and he was always coaching and leading people and teaching people how to do things. And he had a extensive knowledge of music. He had a record collection he would keep. So we hear, I think all of that is the most important to remember of who these people were. And Kim Lane, she lost her husband, Richard Lane. So we hear about them, and they got married, and she ended up burying him, having his funeral at the same place they ended up getting married. So I think things like that is what puts those numbers into perspective of these were, you know, loving brothers, fathers, husbands, grandfathers. You know, some of them had multiple grandchildren. Some of them were in their 20s. There's one that died, Corey Davis. He was 20 years old.
Yeah, I saw the age range, and that's something that stuck out to me. Like, you had people as young as 20 to, I think, as old as like 61. So this was people in all stages of their lives.
Yep. And the way mining works, like when you have that age range, and I worked in the, you know, when I was a surface miner, I was early 20s, and all the older coal miners, essentially they become father figures. Like, you look up to them and you have more respect for them pretty much than almost anyone in your life. I'm sure. And you're with these people for 60 hours a week. So, you know, each of these 29 were also family with each other. And that's what coal mining is. It's a brother and sisterhood. It's family, you know, in the majority of things, it's just always comes back to family. So that was the first goal. And I feel like we met that, you know. Obviously I'd love to do more extensive stories about each of these men, because, you know, everything I've heard is just incredible. We did phone interviews with someone who lost her brother, and we did interviews with that same person's grandson about how they found out, you know, they were 15 years old on a hunting trip and they found out that their grandfather died. You know, all of this stuff is just so important to hear. It's devastating to hear, but it's important because we have to put that emotion with this tragedy so we can figure out how to keep this from happening again.
Absolutely.
So yeah, and go ahead. I was going to touch on some more points, but
well, I wanted to ask. I know you obviously talked to a lot of family members of the miners who were killed in this disaster. What are they hoping to, like, I'm trying to figure out how to word this. What's something that they, if it still bothers them about this, have they brought up things like, I wait, like, do they have closure on this? Do they feel like justice was served? What's that been like for them?
There's no, I don't have a sense of closure at all. It's just, they're just living and they're figuring out, you know, as each year goes by, they're figuring out how to do that better. But obviously it'll always be there. And you know, the main reason that they wanted to speak was to just explain who their loved one was.
Yeah.
It was just like, this is who this person was behind all of these headlines and, you know, this and that, and, you know, the trials and Massey and the Don Blankenships and the performance Coles and all of that. Like, these are who these people were, and here's what they meant to me. So that was their main goal. It's just such a confusing event, of everything that happened. Now, and that was part of it too. Like, I wanted to know, like, okay, what was the ignition source? What caused the explosion? What was Upper Big Branch's safety record before this? What was the culture like there? And, what did MSHA do that was wrong? You know, I know they came in and they threw the book at them and did this and that and whatever, but I'm going to look beyond that. Like, what's MSHA's role in this? Because I think that it's so much more gray than what people, like to think it is, because, you know, we like to say, oh, that's the reason this happened. That's, you know, it's like how people vote. They like to think like, oh, this one side cares about me way more than this other side. Well, unfortunately, with this, like, I think there is blame for several parties.
100%.
And some of them are more accountable than others. So they've just started with that. It was just going to each question I had and figuring out, like, okay, well, Performance Coal mentioned there being a 35-foot crack at the shearer that inundated the mine with natural gas. Let me look into that. Let me look into the chemistry here. Don Blankenship is saying that, you know, it was a natural gas inundation. What does that mean? MSHA is saying that it was a coal dust explosion. The state as well, the West Virginia Office of Miners Health, Safety, and Training is saying it's a coal dust explosion. What does that mean? How did they prove that? So it was just going one by one. And I think, you know, obviously I'm not an expert. This is all my interpretation of the facts that I found. But I believe I have at least a 95% explanation on the podcast as to a majority of what happened. Now, some things we will never find out what happened. And I mentioned that as well, but yeah, overall, I'm very happy with how the explanations happened with each event, because it seems like it's resonating with people, because you hear all this stuff and people can throw, like, oh, methane, ethane, propane, you know, natural gas, all this stuff out there. And then a typical person like I did is just going to be like, oh, well, I have no clue what that means, so let me just move on with my life. I guess they sound like they're telling the truth.
Yeah.
So that works for me. So I kind of wanted to break it. I mean, just the investigation episode is an hour and 20 minutes long. So,
Doubt it. I remember when at least one of the investigations was happening, I think it was Davitt McAteer was leading, maybe. Cause I interviewed him in my college journalism class when I was at Shepherd University about that. And it was as it was happening. And there's just that, you're right, there's so much culpability to go around. Like, obviously the coal operators share a large part of that, but, you know, this whole disaster exposed a lot of underlying problems with the regulatory landscape of how the Mine Safety Health Administration operates, how there are perverse incentives to just pay fines rather than fix problems in mines, all of those things. So, and I think maybe some of it got addressed, but some of it didn't at the time. It's just a tangled web of different things. And so I'm really glad that you have taken the time to dive into this, because I mean, to my knowledge, I don't think anybody has done it, especially in a podcast form like this. So I think it's really powerful. I'm wondering, to wrap up here, what sticks out to you as the most important part of this podcast series, or something that mattered the most to you, was most important to you?
Yep. So there are multiple answers to this question, but I'll go with the safety side of things first. The government failed right after this happened. There was the Miners Health Safety Act of 2010. The government failed to even pass that bill, mm-hmm. which would have instantly improved safety in coal mining and ultimately saved lives. How many lives? I don't know. But the reason being is because Robert C. Byrd was behind this bill and he passed away. So it just died, as things tend to do with legislation. So that was very upsetting. But MSHA has implemented a couple things, like the respirable dust rule. They've implemented that, I think it was in 2014. So that is lowering the chances of black lung. Now, granted, you know, the more you're in the mines, the higher your chances are. But it done things like, you know, personal dust monitors are required in all mines now, and some things like that, which is great. But a huge part of this was, there's a guy named Bill Tucker who was the lead investigator for the state of UBB. Well, he was in good health before this, and now I love Bill to death. He's a super awesome guy. He can barely breathe. And the reason is, he filed for workers' comp for this, and his doctors were saying that it was directly as a result as to what happened, you know, during the investigation of UBB. So the state contests the workers' comp. They send him to their panel of doctors. I believe it was in Pittsburgh. They concur with his doctors that it was exactly correlated to what he breathed during the investigation at UBB. And he was awarded his workers' comp, thankfully. But that is on record. The state also put in their report, there's this thing called barefaced exploration. And mine rescue members are the best of the best. I know so many good people that are mine rescue members. So this is, you know, they're doing what the process states. The process of barefaced exploration is where a mine rescue team goes into a mine, into a certain point. Now think of a mine that just blew up, flames, smoke, you know, who knows what's in the air. There's never been any testing on the environment after an explosion. So currently it's called, in the books, barefaced exploration. MSHA has it in their books. They walk in, because your apparatus only has 4 hours of oxygen. So they got to preserve their oxygen because they got to get in there so far and then look around. So they monitor their carbon monoxide and their oxygen levels. And that's what tells them when to put their apparatus on. Until then, it's called barefaced exploration, where they walk in with no organic respirator or anything into these mines and look around to preserve their oxygen. Because the goal is to save lives. They're going in there to save lives. So they want to hold that oxygen as long as they can. But we have got to get something in place to where they provide these men with organic respirators to put on until it's time to go under air, because it is such a cost effective and simple solution. And there has been multiple people having breathing issues directly as a result to their role in the investigation. So that's number one that I know we could change now and wouldn't, you know, I don't get some money in there for some research to test what this environment is like, what these men are breathing. and then just put on a respirator. I know, you know, so that's number one. You know, other ones being, and that's, you know, going against MSHA, but a big thing I learned is I wondered, you know, this natural gas inundation theory, that Performance Coal puts out and Don Blankenship, is I was curious, like, okay, well, I wonder what their report says. Well, I couldn't find the report anywhere online. That was the one report, because I knew I couldn't make the podcast without it.
Right.
Because the every other report, essentially, they don't state the same thing. Each one is very detailed. And I highly suggest checking all of them out. There's David McAteer's, the UMWA's, which I didn't use the UMWA's as much because UBB is a non-union coal mine. So obviously that one's going to be heavily biased, but I was a union miner, so I love the union, but that's why. And the states and MSHA's, well, Performance Coal also had a report that I couldn't find. I came across a journalist that had it, thankfully, and he sent it to me. And there's a lot of contradicting statements when it comes to the ventilation problem. So there's a whole ventilation saying, you know, Don Blankenship and it says that MSHA mandated changes that cut the air in half. That's a real popular theory. But I, you know, and I'll say this on here, that their Performance Coal's report states that the ventilation was working properly on the day of the explosion, and they had more than enough required air for the mine, despite MSHA's misjudgments. Now, that's not verbatim, but that's essentially what they say. They spend a whole section, I think it's called Conclusion 4, that goes through the ventilation issue. So it's contradicting. So stuff like that is what leads me to just be like, oh, that's a huge takeaway for me, because that a contradicting statement, you know, why'd you change it later? Or, you know, stuff like that is what throws out, you know, is what helps me think that I've found the truth. But yeah, the biggest takeaway was Bill's situation safety wise. And the other, you know, the emotional side of it, I mean, it was just a devastating experience, and it will always stick with me. I would find myself reading these eulogies online and looking at these men's photos, and you know, it would just be a heavy presence. I didn't know anyone personally that was lost. I do have a best friend who lost a best friend. So, you know, I'm glad I had that resource to let him hear, because he doesn't want to talk about it. And I think that hearing their opinions on it is the most important, so yeah, I can figure out how to do this properly. So just the heaviness of it all, and the devastation and the ripple effects of these 29 men. I mean, you have people who have PTSD who called in that day, who have survivor's guilt. You have, you know, and that they feel guilty for watching their daughter grow up because their friends didn't get to. You know, you have people who knew all 29, and not only knew them, but were close with them.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, remembering what they go through. And I know this is going to bring up hurt and pain in their life. And that was my biggest regret with this, is I don't want to cause more, but I don't want us to get 40 years down the road and forget, just like we have about the disaster in Kentucky. So
absolutely. Cause as the days go by, the resources dwindle, you know, people get older, they pass away. So those human resources that can provide that perspective aren't always going to be there. So I think it's incredibly important what you've done and are doing with this. And, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about it. Where can people find the podcast? I'm assuming on all podcast streaming platforms.
Sure. Yeah, it is on essentially every platform. I think there's up to 20 platforms, completely free. Again, this is completely nonprofit. I'm not taking a dollar for reimbursement. And also, I'm finding a lot of analytics coming from the website, because a lot of people don't know what a podcast is, and they're not really tech savvy when it comes to that. And a lot of people who have, you know, elders and things like that that want to listen, they can go to upperbigbranch.com and you can actually listen to all the episodes right there. And on it too, I mean, the response has been overwhelming. We uploaded to Buzzsprout, and we uploaded last Friday. We did the full release. And according to all the analytics, so on Buzzsprout, the top 1% of their podcast, which is like, you know, 1,200 podcasts or so, the top 1% after their first 7 days receive around 4,700 downloads. Mm-hmm. Well, we broke 10,000 downloads in six wow. days across.
That's incredible.
I think that a big reason for that is the podcast is speaking for itself and people are really resonating with the information and, you know, hopefully, you know, again, I'm not an expert, but hopefully it'll answer some questions that people may have, or they may learn things that they may not have known. But either way, I just appreciate anyone who takes the time, and we have a Facebook page as well, UBB, A Coal Miner Story, that you can go on and get involved in the dialogue. And there's debates. I allow debates, and I think debates are important. And, you know, if you hear something wrong, or if your story's different, if you have some kind of evidence that contradicts the podcast, I want to know about it. This is an ongoing thing that is just looking for the truth. So I appreciate it.
It's awesome. I love that. And I'll include all that in the show notes for people to check out. JD, thanks so much for coming on, for sharing what you're doing, and for just doing this incredible and thoughtful project. I mean, I think this is a story that needs to be told, and especially the stories of the people who survived or the surviving family members. So really appreciate what you're doing, and wish you the best of luck.
Thanks, Chuck. I really appreciate it.
All right, that was our interview with JD Belcher. You can check the show notes to listen to his podcast or learn more about him. Thank you all for listening to that. I really loved it. I thought it was a great interview. So I'm gonna snip the episode here and send you right back into my discussion with Big John. We talk a little bit about a minor request that we have for all you musicians out there, and then we get into your favorite, the beef.
All right. Chuck, one thing I wanted to talk about was we obviously have been talking about the changes that are coming and the things that we want to do. And one of the big things that we have discussed is looking more at the culture and people of Appalachia rather than just simply politicians and the politics of the region. So the biggest thing that I could think of is looking at things like food, music, even TV shows. But for right now, we posted on Instagram and Twitter asking people to tell us about their favorite bands in the region. And the response is insane with the amount of people that have replied. Maybe you're used to it, but I can't believe how many people have tagged their favorite bands. Did you see that?
Yeah, it's I mean, hundreds and hundreds of comments. It's wild. I you know, we have a network of people, but I didn't realize that they were all that engaged. And it's exciting to see there's that many, like, musicians out there. It's wild.
Right, because we asked, like, from emo to country to any type of genre. We didn't care. We just wanted to hear, you know, who was in the scene. So, first off, give us time to look at those. And second off, if you're a band, if you're a band that's tagged in those, send us a message. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear about your band. We'd love to hear, you know, what you're doing. Are you touring? Are you putting out a new album? Things like that. One thing that Chuck and I have talked about is, and Chuck, you have to tell me, did the playing a new artist change? Did that go away?
Yeah, like we started getting less and less input, and then we just never re-upped it. We never made another ask sure. for it, and it just didn't happen. But I really want to get back to it because it was a great way to discover new bands and to get artists who maybe aren't as well known a little bit more of a bump. And we've had some musicians on from Appalachia, but I want to just keep doing this because it's a great way to just get better stuff on our show.
It's so much more organic too. Like people, like the real people, like I said, I would love to have every band on. That's obviously not possible, but you know, to have musicians on to talk about their art, to have people who are changing the culture here in Appalachia or just, you know, furthering it. I would love to go to Appalachian restaurants and talk to, you know, the chefs and owners and see what they're doing, what makes them different, what makes them, you know, unique. These are the things that I think are going to be, you know, really exciting. So the focus right now is tell us about your favorite musicians in the region, get us connected with them, and let's go from there. So that's really just the gist of it. We've even talked about how, you know, not even just sponsors, but just getting companies in general, some awareness out there in the region to tell people that they exist. That's something else we want to do. So if you're a company in the region, and you're trying to get your name out there and your product is great and you're a progressive company, or you treat your employees with respect and you pay them a decent wage and you take care of them, hit us up. Let us know. Those are things that we want to do. We want to use this platform to essentially advance the people in the region, not just focus on the politics of it.
Yeah, I love it. I'm excited to do it. And honestly, we can have a new band with a different song that's opening this show every week, then that's the dream, baby.
I would love that. So if you're a band and you want to give us the ability to use your music, send us a message. We would love to be able to use it. We're not going to use it without your permission, because we ain't trying to get sued. So if you want us to use it, put it on episode, please let us know.
Let's just get right into the beef. I'm not even gonna mix and match and bullshit. Let's do it. I want to hear it. I don't know anything about it.
If you bother by heat, back up off the grill. My boy Big John's finna fix you up a mill. Yeah, your brother rules, that's a big deal. Got your mouth full, but it don't matter still. Y'all want some beef with Big John, but at the same time, don't you beef with Big John. Trying to be the man, but you sweet when it's time. Open up wide and don't leave till it's gone. Eat your beef with Big John. Eat your beef with Big John. This is beef with Big John. Y'all got beef with Big John.
All right, well, when this episode airs, we will be either on, about, or right past a major holiday in the United States and the world, Chuck. It occurs every year on April 20th, and it is something that a lot of people hold near and dear to their hearts, and that is 420.
420, smoke them up.
And again, look, I talked about it before. My beefs are not going to be just Appalachian, but it is going to be something that affects all of us, right? And one thing that affects all of us that we've talked about is cannabis and the delivery of it, the legal delivery of it, I should say, not the illegal delivery. But anyway, this beef comes.
That happens too.
That's fair. This beef comes all the way from the West in California. There's a company there. I don't know if it's called EZ or Ease. E-A-Z.
Ease.
Okay, Ease.
I actually interviewed with them a couple of years back.
Perfect.
For a public affairs manager.
They're
going to
be super pissed about this then. I have a beef with them, Chuck. I don't know if you've seen this, but the workers are apparently ready to strike on 420. So you have to imagine, this is the biggest business day of the year, I assume. And
I would have to assume.
I would have to assume. The workers are ready to strike because they're upset about the wages, the amount of money that they're paid per mileage, and the lack of benefits. It's something that they've been fighting for over and over again, but the company has continued to resist. I believe that they've even cut the amount of hours and money being paid to their workers. So the workers are essentially fed up. They're going to strike on 420, which I 100% support. Get your money. These companies, especially like cannabis companies, cannabis delivery, all of those, they're making a ton of money. They're doing well, obviously. California obviously has more competition, but they should still treat their workers with respect, dignity, and pay them a living wage. That's not currently happening. They're not getting the benefits. So this week's beef is pretty simple. I just got beef with this company because we've talked about it for so long, especially something as progressive as legal weed. And we're starting to revert back to these ways where we just manipulate employees, we take advantage of them, and we continue to, you know, prolong these issues that are that we've faced in employment forever. So do better. That's what I'm saying.
Look, I think it's a brilliant idea for them to strike on 420 because
hell yeah.
There's no better strategy for labor organizing than that. I mean, it's like Amazon workers striking on Prime Day or something. You know,
dude, that you're right. That's a great comparison. I didn't even
just
think about
that.
Perfect comparison. You go right for the jugular. That's what these workers can do. And I mean, who's gonna start delivering product? The CEO? No, they're gonna strike them when it hurts. 420 is the best way to do it. I support these workers. I'm so happy that they're fighting for essentially what's right, and I'm very sad about this company that's taking advantage of them. Not all beefs are going to be in Appalachia. I saw this. I had to talk about it, and it's one thing that we always love, which is unionization.
Look, I mean, doesn't have to be in Appalachia to affect Appalachia too. And as we've discussed throughout the years, unionizing throughout the country is just on the rise right now, and workers are finally taking back the power and taking back what's rightfully theirs. So we're excited to see it. We love to see it, and happy 420 to them. And I hope that they get what they want.
And happy 420 to all of you listeners. Absolutely. I hope that if you're sober, that's cool. But if you're enjoying a little bit of cannabis right now, maybe you're enjoying a little bit of cornbread hemp. That's cool. I'm glad. I'm probably funnier that way. So I appreciate it. Happy 420. Chuck, happy 420 to you. This has been a great episode. I am 420'd out right now, and I am ready. I'm ready to record the next episode. Let's go.
Let it rip, baby. All right, happy 420, you all. Thank you all so much for listening to us and supporting us over all these years. We appreciate you. We love you, and we'll talk to you next week.